It seems to me that one of the ways to understand the parsha, to understand the events, and ultimately to understand what happened to Yosef, or for that matter, what his plan was to compare the various times that he speaks within this narrative of, shall we call it the Yosef and his brothers narrative, but not the one when Yosef was still with his family before the sale. Before the sale, things were different. Before the sale, Yosef was young and with all of his hopes and literally dreams. And he speaks and he annoys them when he speaks. But now there's a different Yosef. And again, if we just give a little bit of thought, in this week's parsha, in Vayigash, there's going to be a time that Yosef speaks to them, but what's going to be important about that time, it's going to be a talk or words are going to come out, which seems to be words that he can't control, which means there is a breakdown over here. Not a breakdown in a sense that he's that there's an emotional breakdown in the way the term is normally used, but rather there is an emotional breakdown, and that's certainly the way that the Torah describes it when said in chapter 45, Perek Mem Hei, V'lo yichal Yosef lehitapek l'kol ha'nitzavim alav. And Yosef can no longer hold back and all those in front of him. V'yikra hutzi kol ish me'alai. And he calls for all the people to be sent away. V'lo amad ish ito b'tvaday Yosef elachav. And no one else is there. So you could say that there is like this moment before the dam bursts, there is a little bit of control, and he does ask everyone else to leave, and there's various opinions about that. Is it his brother's honor that he's concerned about? Is it his own honor to say that, you know, you sold me is not going to be the most dignified thing that a man like Yosef would want to reveal to the people that work for him, the people that know about him? You don't want that to end up in the, I won't say it'll be the front page of the newspaper article the next day. The front page will be Yosef's family arrives, but there will be a mention, and maybe the subheading will be Yosef ended up coming to Egypt under the most unusual circumstances, in terms of that his brothers rejected him and sold him and was off as a slave, which of course is a part of the story, but it's not necessarily a part of the story that Yosef ever wants to reveal. I mean, sometimes we get involved with the question, does Yosef want his father to ever know what happened? Does Yosef ever tell his father what happened? Does his father ever learn what happened? Does Yaakov go to his death? And that's, of course, a question which is more involved in Parshat Vayechi, when the brothers come and tell Yosef that Yaakov said such and such before he died. So that's the question, were they being truthful or not being truthful? But at the point that we are right now, when Yosef is about to speak, this is a speech which he can't hold back. And as I used the term before, or the metaphor, the dam is about to break. Vayitin et kol bevchi. And then what actually happens is crying comes forth. Vishmu Mitzrayim vishma beit paro. And that was known all over that Yosef, again, had this emotional outburst. But what really concerns me is the way the Torah articulates it. And then it says, Vayomer Yosef el Achav. Yosef says to his brothers, Ani Yosef. And he reveals himself. So the first thing that he does is he says, I am Yosef, which probably for them answered a whole bunch of questions in terms of the experiences that they've been having over the last, probably I'll assume, couple of months. But then he continues and he says, Ha'od Avichai, is my father still alive? And now it's at this point that the brothers are overwhelmed emotionally. The brothers couldn't speak, couldn't say anything because they're absolutely shocked or frightened in front of him. So what we have over here is a pair of two different sides, Yosef versus the brothers, and each side is overwhelmed. Yosef is overwhelmed by emotion, and the brothers are overwhelmed by a different emotion. That emotion is fear. But I do want to go back to Yosef. I mean, we could possibly compare this to when Yosef does meet the brothers the first time, although I think that's very, very different. There we're told all the way back in Perek Mem Bet that Yosef is in charge, as it were, Vayavo b'nei Yisrael l'shbor b'toch habayim, and among all the people that came looking for food were the children of Yaakov, ki haya ra'av b'eretz Kanaan, because in Canaan there was a famine. V'Yosef hu ha'shalit al ha'aretz, and Yosef is the person who is in charge of the land. Hu ha'mashbir l'kol ha'aretz, and he's the one who takes care of providing food for all the people of all the nations who come. Now, I'll just pause right there in the middle of the pasuk. Yosef knows in the back of his mind that the brothers are going to come, and maybe not in the back of his mind. Again, I would assume that the same person, namely Yosef, who is able on the spot to come up with a 14-year plan, an economic plan for Paro, and overwhelms Paro and all of his advisors with the brilliance of his plan, I assume that Yosef is always one who sees into the future, and Yosef realizes that his brothers will be coming as well, because he knows that there's a famine, and there's a famine all over, and people are coming from all over. And I assume that Yosef always has his eyes open, taking, looking and seeing, you know, when will there be people traveling from the land of Canaan that will always pique his interest, hear a word about his family, maybe some kind of piece of information. But specifically, at that moment when he sees his brothers coming, this cannot be a complete surprise. What I'm really trying to say then is that the experience that Yosef has when he finally breaks down and he says who he is, versus when Yosef sees his brothers, is one, he's really prepared, and other, I don't think he is as prepared. Which means, what does he actually say to them when they come? Again, I'm going to pause. There's probably another couple of times that we can compare these two times to. There's a time that the brothers come back the second time. And at that point, again, Yosef's is, or should be, completely prepared for their coming, because he knows they're coming back. He may not know how many will come back. He may not know if they're going to defy his words. And he may actually have a different plan in the back of his mind. It could very well be that Yosef doesn't believe that Yaakov is going to let Binyamin go, or Yaakov would let Binyamin go by himself. And maybe even Yaakov himself would take upon himself to take this trip in order to keep an eye on Binyamin and make sure that nothing happens to him. Which means Yosef, from his side, and that's part of what's important in this whole narrative and therefore dialogue, both sides don't know what the other side has experienced over the last number of years. Which means the brothers of Yosef have no idea that this is Yosef. They have no idea what happened to him. As far as they know, Yosef may not even be alive anymore. And as far as they know, Yosef could be a slave someplace. And that's part of the issue, is they've always underestimated him. And therefore, they may not at all, again, the last place they would suspect to see him is the person in charge of Egypt. And that's not what they've ever expected or thought about him. So we'll place that on the side for the moment. When the brothers come back the second time, Yosef knows, and not in this kind of back of his mind, his brothers should be coming soon. No, he has set a plan in motion. The plan in motion was for the brothers, if they want more food, to come back with Binyamin. They're essentially stuck. So as I said, over here, he should be far more prepared when they actually do come. So that's another time. There was, shall we say, another time in between those two, and that's after Yosef throws him in the prison, and then he overhears Reuven saying to the others, well, you know, how did you do this to the boy? And by the way, at that point, when Yosef hears him speaking about him and speaking about their guilt involved in selling him, it's at that point again that Yosef has this type of a breakdown and is overwhelmed. So, and it could be again, Yosef was not prepared for them to be speaking about him in those kinds of terms. So again, what I'm suggesting is that we really need to compare the various times that there is communication going on between these two sides. I just want to go back and read that section again. Vayomer ish el achiv, this is Perek Membet Pasuk Kaf Aleph, and one said to the other, and we always have the suspicion ish el achiv is Shimon to Levi, Vayomer ish el achiv, but they said to the other, Aval ashimim anachnu, but we're guilty, al achinu, regarding our brother, asher ha'inu tzarat nafsho, and we saw the pain of his soul, b'tchanu eleinu, when he begged us, which is very important because we did not hear that during the sale itself. We know, again, we know that they attacked him and they ripped the clothing off him and they threw him in the pit. And we know that he was dragged out of the pit and then he was sold. But now it gave us this other, again, much more emotional side of it, that we heard him and we heard him cry. We saw the difficulty he was going through when he begged us, Asherainu tzarat nafsho b'tchananu aleinu, when he begged to us, b'lo shamanu, and we had deaf ears toward him. Alkein ba'aleinu hatzarazot, and that's why all this is happening to us. Again, we note the exact parallel. Asherainu tzarat nafsho, we saw the pain that he went through, that he experienced, and therefore, alkein ba'aleinu hatzarazot, and that's why we're experiencing this particular pain. Rabbi Soloveitchik has pointed out that this is analogous to the type of tshuva that is called tshuvat hamishkal, that when one goes through a particular crime, one needs to have a likewise type of a punishment. The Hasidei Ashkenaz were very involved in trying to figure out what exact punishment should be appropriate for each particular crime. And this connection that they're going through, which again, I would personally think that Yosef is leading them towards, this idea that they are going to be imprisoned, which is essentially the punishment for what they've done to him. And again, there may be this incredible act of kindness on Yosef's part, which of course they don't understand it at all. They see, oh, look what's happening to us. And from their perspective, they have no idea. Once you go into prison, they have no idea how in the world they'll be getting out of it. And when Yosef puts them in and only leaves them there for 3 days, which means experientially they go through what Yosef goes through in terms of being a prisoner. On the other hand, the kindness of Yosef is, okay, after 3 days, then they could be forgiven. Which really leads us to an incredible thought that Yosef may very well have been more concerned with his brothers' souls than we ever imagined. And Yosef knows that there is this sin that they have committed and they need to be cleansed of this sin. And Yosef therefore puts them through this particular experience and he creates this incredible, shall we say, sense of catharsis whereby they have relived the sin that they've done, but on the other side, now feeling the plight of the victim. And I think it's not very difficult to read that into the words. And at that moment, it goes even further when Reuven says, Vayan Reuven otam, and Reuven says to them, Lemor, Halo amarti aleichem lemor al tachtu b'yelid. But I've said to you, don't do anything to this sin, v'lo shamatem, and you didn't hear. V'gam demo hinei nidrash. And we hear from his words as well, and now his blood is being required in the sense that now we're going to pay. This is quid pro quo, and there's a God who's running the universe. Again, they don't know who their tormentor is. They don't know that their tormentor is in fact Yosef. But what they do know is that what they're experiencing right now is something which they deserve. Now, but it's at that point that we hear V'heim liyadu ki shomei Yosef. So again, Yosef overhearing this, ki amalitz binotam, because there is, perhaps we'll translate as a translator between them, v'yisov maleim v'yefk, and then Yosef breaks down and cries. Again, this is not something which he was necessarily prepared for. Again, we don't know in his mind what he's thought about his brothers all these years. How cruel are they? How do they ever think about him again? Do they think that he deserved this? Or now they're saying, okay, we deserve to be punished. That was something which overwhelms Yosef. So I'm saying that is something which is interesting. So what I'm trying to compare then are the various responses of Yosef which take place throughout this dialogue and or this ongoing dialogue. And I'll say it again, some of the ones he's prepared for and some he isn't, which means I would assume that in really broad strokes, Yosef has been waiting for his brothers to come, and what he's going to say to them, I think, is very much in his mind. On the other hand, the various times that he breaks down, I think that's something which he did not necessarily prepare, because I think that that's just coming much more from emotion than coming from any other place. So I think that that's the thing that needs to be compared. Again, if we'll take another episode, when Yosef has the cup, his cup, planted in the bag of Binyamin, and then the brothers are dragged back, and then they make their excuses, and they say what they say in front of him, I would say that at that point, Yosef is far more prepared to speak, because he engineered that. He knew that they'll be coming. He knew that they're going to make some kind of argument. And it's also very interesting what Yosef says at that point. Essentially, again, if we'll look at the words, this is towards the end of Perek Mem Dalet. V'yavo Yehuda v'chav beta Yosef, v'yom alem Yosef, mama says, asher asitam, what it is that you did? Halo yodatam ki nachesh yinachesh ish asher kamoni? Didn't you know that I have all these capabilities? Essentially what Yosef is saying to them, you have completely underestimated me, which of course is this wonderful dual message. Again, of course, Yosef is saying, you've underestimated me, who you think is the me, who you think is this Safnat Paneach, this ruler in Egypt, but you've also underestimated me. And that is Yosef. And I would say that that is part of the message that Yosef absolutely wanted to get across to him, which means this may be, I don't even want to call it a game, but this may be a very important part of the dialogue, whereby Yosef is saying, haven't you wondered why in the world you're going through all of this? Haven't you wondered who in the world would be interested in doing this to you? Don't you realize that of course I'm Yosef? Of course I'm the one who is going to put you through these things. But again, I've already pointed out, Yosef has not put them through the things that he could point, or maybe even he should put them through. Which means part of what's going on is that Yosef, and we've made this point in the past, Yosef was a person who worked for Potiphar, who was the chief executioner. He then spent years in the prison of the chief executioner. Yosef has seen things, and Yosef knows things, and Yosef has connections, and if Yosef wants to torture them, he can torture them in all kinds of ways. And instead, what he does is he allows them to go through this catharsis. He gives them 3 days in prison to re-experience what it was like for Yosef, and that is something that, we'll say again, should serve as a way of purifying their souls. That, I mean, if you go back to Rav Yehuda Chassid and the Chassidei Ashkenaz and say, okay, what they went through is exactly the kind of thing that somebody needs in order to, during those 3 days, to reconsider every single part of their lives and every decision that they've made, and most importantly, what happened to Yosef, because now they feel the other side. And sometimes a person may unfortunately need this jarring emotional experience or physical experience in order to know what someone else may feel like. And Yosef gives them that opportunity to feel it in order to fix who they are, but nonetheless, they can be staring at him, but they never can figure it out. And that seems to be a real interesting message that Yosef says. And again, this is the kind of message that I think Yosef was prepared for, where he engineers this. He has the cup put in the bag, and they come up and they make their excuse, and Yosef's message to them, you have underestimated me. That is an important statement, but that I think is cool and calm and collected. I'm not going to say that there's not an emotional element to it, because I think all of us understand that of course there's an emotional element to it. The emotional element is that Yosef needs to say this to them, that you have underestimated me, you have no idea who I am, which again is the most interesting and literal interpretation. You have no idea who I am, you have completely underestimated me, because if you can begin to figure out who I am and how I got here and so on and so forth, then you would have begun to understand who Yosef is, and you never would have done this in the first place, which means this is all wrapped up, but I'll say it again. This kind of speech seems to be much more controlled. Later on, again, I'm not going to go through every single one, although I think we should, but later on, when they come back from the funeral of Yaakov and the brothers turn to him. So again, Yosef then is going to break down because still he feels they don't understand him, they don't know who he is, and still they feel that the whole thing was a facade and that he was just waiting for Yaakov to die in order to get his revenge. So again, it goes back to this really the same point. Even though he's revealed himself, they still don't know who he is. Even though he's revealed himself, they still have completely underestimated him. And Yosef's response is the same response that he gave, and he will give in this week's parashah, but Yigash, no, I will take care of you. Don't worry, I will give you what you need. I will take care of your food, and I will take care of everything. And the brothers, again, even after revealed, they still don't know really who Yosef is, which I guess is a part of the tragedy. But this leads us back to what I think is really the main issue, is when Yosef reveals himself in Vayigash, what he says is, I am Yosef. Again, the words, Ani Yosef ha'od avichai. I am Yosef, is my father still alive? And at this point, the focus is on his father. On the other hand, when we find Yosef meeting up his brothers after all these years, what Yosef says to them, and again, we'll look back over there in Perek Mem Bet, there they all come in, Yosef's in charge, they bow down to him, which itself for Yosef should be incredibly important, the fact that they're bowing down. Vayar Yosef et achav vayakirem. Yosef sees his brothers and recognizes them. Vayinaker aleihem, and he makes himself like a stranger to them. Vayidiber itam kashot, and he speaks harshly. And now you have to ask ourselves, is this something that Yosef is doing in a calm, collected, premeditated fashion? Is this the plan? Vayom aleihem ayin batem, he says, where have you come from? Again, those are the first words. Where do you come from? Which could be, possibly, he just wants to make 100% sure. Vayom aleihem eretz kanan l'shbarach, we've come from the land of Canaan to get food. Vayikar Yosef et achav, he recognizes them. Vayim lo yikiru, but they don't recognize him. Which means, again, this underestimation, not knowing who he is. It's right here. Vayiskor Yosef et achalamot. Yosef remembers the dreams. And again, from his perspective, they just now bow down to him, which means we have at least a partial success in terms of the dreams. Vayiskor Yosef et achalamot shechalam lahem. And he remembers the dreams that he dreamt regarding them or for them even. Vayomale miraglim atem. And he goes, you are miraglim. Now notice what takes place over here. And again, the contrast. Over here in this well-thought-out, prepared statement, Yosef sees them. They underestimate them, him. They cannot possibly imagine the man standing in front of them as Yosef. And then Yosef's words to them have nothing at this point to do with the father, which is going to be the main focus later on. Rather, what Yosef says is about them. You are treacherous people. Now you kind of wonder, how specific can Yosef be by saying you're treacherous people? You people are not people to be trusted. You people have done things which I'm sure you're embarrassed about, which means hint after hint after hint being dropped over here, and they're taken, you know, aback. I mean, they think that they're honorable people, which is exactly what their response is. But they all know deep inside, as we just saw what takes place afterwards, when they do say to one another, listen, but we're guilty. Which means they're standing here and putting on this face of presenting themselves in the nicest possible way. We are honorable people. We're good people. We're decent people. And I can just add one more sentence, which they don't say. There are no skeletons in our closet. And essentially what Yosef says, there are skeletons in your closet. Essentially what Yosef says is that you have things that you need to be embarrassed about. Not only that, you have things you need to fix. There's somebody that you still need to be looking for. There's healing which needs to take place in this family. And until you recognize you've done something wrong, that healing can't possibly take place, which has, in my mind, huge implications, not just for what takes place in Sefer Bereishit, but for the Jewish people moving forward in terms of can there or will there be healing between the various sides, the children of Leah and the children of Rachel? Will Yaakov's family be whole? Will it not be whole? But if they don't realize that there are skeletons indeed in their closet, and they don't realize that there is blood on their hands, even if not in a literal sense, but when they sold Yosef, there was blood on their hands, and that's the taking of his coat and dipping it in blood. So the realization they've done something wrong is really part of what needs to take place over here. But it's interesting that Yosef's main thrust and focus over here at this point is towards them. Meraglim atem. You are people who are spies. You're not honest people, you're treacherous people. And their response, of course, is no, we're honest people. We are good, decent, honest people. And Yosef says, yeah, really, you're not. He doesn't go far as saying, you know it and I know it. But essentially, that's what's communicated over here. And that's really what's important, is that Yosef communicates things to them all along the way. But again, what I want to point out is there is a major difference between when he is prepared versus what happens afterwards. And this is going to really help us to understand in Vayigash, when Yosef finally reveals, now it's not about the brothers. That initial emotional statement that comes out is Ha'od Avichai. And that's part of what we need to understand, why that's what comes out. Afterwards, when they couldn't speak and they were shocked, then Yosef comes back to the continuation, which I think is far more measured and something which I think he was ready to say all along, which in a sense is a very calming statement. I'm Yosef, your brother, who you've sold. And that's really this flip side of it. I'm your brother who you've sold. You don't sell brothers, which is essentially what you're saying. Again, V'yoma ni Yosef achichem, asher machartim oti Mitzrayma. But then he continues, V'ata al te'atzvu, but don't be upset, don't be sad. V'al yichar b'nechem, and don't be angry, ki machartim oti eina, because you've sold me. Hinei l'michya shalachani elokim lefnechem, that God has a larger plan, and I'm part of God's plan, and I accept God's plan, and which really is essentially what Yosef's message is going to be to them. But the initial outburst is Ha'od Avichai. Now the question is, why is that the thing that comes out? And on a logical level, if Yaakov is not alive, we would probably have to reevaluate every single thing which happens along the way, especially this last part of Yosef revealing himself. If Yaakov isn't alive, so then the stakes are very, very different. If Yaakov isn't alive, then maybe Yosef would treat the brothers a little differently, which means that, and if Yaakov wasn't alive, then why would Yehuda be giving this speech? If Yaakov wasn't alive, why in the world would Yehuda be saying, listen, I'll take Binyamin's place? Because as far as they're concerned, it may actually be the case that Binyamin is guilty. That's a possibility, which means there's really two possibilities over here. One possibility is that there are really strange things going on in this palace, which, by the way, there's evidence for. The first time they go there, stuff was put in their bag, and they all know that. But again, that may be part of this punishment that they deserve. And the money is put back in their bag, which again, something which I've pointed out in the past, that when they sold Yosef, they left a brother behind, but now they had money in their hands or money in their bags, or according to some tradition, they buy shoes with it. But now when they leave and there's money in their bag, it could be that Yosef is being incredibly, incredibly sharp and maybe even you would say cynical by virtue of putting the money in the bag, right, by giving them money, but leaving one of the brothers behind, namely Shimon, in order to recreate this experience about the sale of Yosef. But moving forward, if Binyamin is guilty, then why take his place? If Yaakov is still alive, it makes perfect sense to take his place because he doesn't want to. And that's what Yehuda's whole speech is. Yehuda's whole speech is going through all the events, but it's interesting. He doesn't give one word of excuse. He doesn't say, but, you know, the stuff was planted on us. It doesn't say, but we're innocent, which means in a certain sense, it sounds very much like Yehuda knows they're not innocent. They may not be guilty of the crime they're being accused of, but he knows they're not innocent. And they know that there is some deserving of punishment over here. And the 3 days that Yosef put them through was not really enough. They know that they deserve much more. And maybe this is really a case of really of what we can call of crime and punishment, where Yehuda knows that he committed the crime and therefore he knows that he is deserving of punishment and is seeking out his punishment. And Binyamin is guiltless, and why should he be punished at all? So he should go free. But if Yaakov's alive, it all makes sense. If Yaakov isn't alive and Yehuda's doing this nonetheless, that would really be an incredible statement. I'm not willing to say that that's what Yosef is asking. Is my father really alive, and what's really going on over here? Yehuda, are you really completely rehabilitated that you realize you were deserving of punishment and it's not really about my father? But if we read the words of Yehuda's speech, that's completely what it is. Yehuda doesn't say, listen, you're right, I've done bad things, which, by the way, he could have said from the very beginning. He could have said from the very beginning, if he wants to defend Binyamin, I stole it, I put it in his bag, I'm the one who's guilty. So what are they going to say? He admitted guilt, and he said, I stuck it in someone else's bag because you know, sometimes, not that I have a great deal of experience with smuggling, but I would assume that the person who's actually smuggling has a look on their face and they look guilty or something like that. And therefore, Yehuda knows there's nothing on him. He's able to then to leave without any guilt on his face. And Binyamin's going to have no guilt because he has no idea that it's in his bag. So Yehuda can say, yeah, I planted it on him so that he can be the quote-unquote mule, the drug mule, as it were, the cup mule, the one who's carrying it. He has no idea that he's actually carrying it. But Yehuda doesn't do that. Instead, Yehuda gives a speech. And I think that that's really what we need to pay attention to, because it seems to be that what Yosef does is he's responding to the speech. And the speech is all about Yaakov. The speech is about how Yaakov had different kids and Yaakov loved his son and Yaakov went through all this and they made a vow to Yaakov. And this whole thing is about Yaakov. And it's at that point, which means the focus of Yaakov, which really causes the breakdown on the side of Yosef. But maybe we need to be a little bit sharper and to understand this a little bit better. What's Yosef doing? On the one hand, yes, I can speak about him taking responsibility for the souls of his brothers and the rehabilitation. What's his end game? So I want to go back a little bit again. And this is, again, something which Rabbi Soloveitchik had said. Yosef believes in the dreams. All along the way, Yosef believes in dreams and believes the dreams are either akin to prophecy, if not prophecy itself. We need to remember, you know, even go back to Yaakov. Yaakov's first big prophecy that he has takes place in a dream. Yaakov's experiences themselves, again, of the divine are in dreams. We have every reason to believe that Yosef understands that dreams that take place are part of a divine communication. And he essentially says that. It's in terms of the dreams of the Sar HaMashkim, of the wine steward later on. Certainly he says it clearly in the dreams of Paro that God is speaking, that God is letting us know, letting Paro know what it is that he wants. If we take that formula and go back to Yosef's own dreams, this is what God wants. A number of commentaries say this clearly. Most famously, I think, is the Ramban, who says that Yosef believes that these things are dreams. The Netziv says it also very clearly that these dreams are prophecies. Sorry, I stated that. That the Ramban says that these dreams, again, how clear it is, if it's 100% clear, that these dreams are akin to prophecy. The Netziv says it clearly, these dreams are prophecy, and therefore Yosef has no right to hold back, to withstand, or to withhold the prophecy. One of the things a prophet must share, the prophecy, and that's something which Yosef needs to do. He needs to make sure that the dreams come true. And yes, there are those who will argue on this Ramban, the Kedah Yitzchak, others say that dreams are the realm of God. Let God make sure, even if they're prophecies, a man should do what's ethical. But what is the point of what's not ethical over here? And this leads me back to what Rabbi Soloveitchik said, that Yosef understands something, and that is, in his mind, the dreams have to come true. And the dreams have to come true. They have not been complete yet. And especially if we pay attention to the difference between the first dream and the second dream. The first dream was the various brothers bowing down. Well, still, technically, there was one brother missing, and that was Binyamin. But there's another issue, and that is the second dream, that it speaks of his father and his mother. And that was something which Yaakov questions him on. And we're told by the commentaries, by the Midrashim, that the mother over here does not mean the woman who gave birth to him, but rather the woman who raised him, and that is Bilhah. And actually, keeping in mind of the Yosef-Bilhah relationship probably gives us a little bit more information in terms of the Reuven-Bilhah outrage, because he is acting out on anger over here, not only towards Yaakov in terms of what he's doing, but it could actually be an attack on Yosef. I mean, in a sense, what he's really doing is he's laying claim to being the firstborn and to being the king, as it were, for leadership. And if you think I'm reading too much into it, so it's probably best for another time, another discussion. But the background of the whole story of the Yosef story is, and these are the kings who ruled in by Edom, by Esav, before there were kings in Israel, which means who's going to be a king of Israel is actually the issue. And that's the brothers say it. The brothers, when they hear Yosef's dreams, they say, what, are you going to be the Melech? Are you going to be the Moshal? Are you going to lord over us? Are you going to be the king? Are we really going to bow down to you? And of course, the irony is that when Yosef says this, when the brothers say this, they've just now interpreted the dreams. And indeed, that's what's going to happen. They're going to bow down to him. And they do bow down to him, except one is missing. So how important is this? I mean, dream fulfillment, if you get to 90%, is that good enough? Or you need 100%? But Binyamin needs to bow down, and he does. And when he comes back the second time with them, then all the brothers bow down. So at this point, we can say that that first dream was now completely fulfilled, but there was another element, which is the most difficult element, and that difficult element is Yaakov bowing down. And one of the points of the Ramban is that that can't take place in the land of Israel. And the Ramban then raises the famous question, where he's not the first and certainly not the only to raise it, why is it that Yosef had never reached out? Why is it that Yosef had never tried to let his father know where he is? Why is it that Yosef had never tried to let his father know so he won't be mourning for him anymore, to know that, you know, Yosef is here? And the Ramban says that Yosef's motivation is because the dreams have to come true, and they wouldn't take place in the natural way, which in the land of Israel. What I think that he means by this is that Yaakov can't bow down to Yosef if he knows that it's Yosef. The only way Yaakov can bow down to Yosef is just the only way that Yaakov could bow down to Yosef is just like the way the brothers bow down to Yosef, and that is when they had no idea that it was Yosef. Which means the very first time they bow down to him, is this fulfillment of the dream? I mean, this is akin to the question, if a tree falls in a forest, does it make any noise? If you bow down to Yosef, but you don't know it's Yosef, have you bowed down to Yosef? Which means they bow down to Tzafnat Paneach. Is that the same thing as bowing down to Yosef? But again, remember Yosef's dream. You're going to bow down, your sheaves will bow down to my sheaves, essentially saying that you will bow down to my economic power. You will bow down to me, really in a literal sense, because you need the sheaves, you need wheat, you need bread, and therefore you will bow down to me in order to get your bread, which is exactly what they do. So again, if you're standing there, if you're Yosef, watching these events being unfolded, you're going to say, wow, these dreams actually did come true, and look how sharply they came true. But nonetheless, we get back to Yaakov. Yosef would seem to understand that there's no way that Yaakov bows down to Yosef, knowing that it's Yosef. Or maybe even further, maybe even in some sense, Yosef can't even let Yaakov bow down to Yosef if he knows that it's Yosef. But Yaakov can do what the brothers have done, and that is bow down to Tzafnat Paneach. Yaakov can bow down to this Egyptian leader, to this Egyptian individual. That's something which he can do. And that's what makes it a little more interesting, especially now if we try to figure out, so really, what exactly is the plan of Yosef? What exactly is it that he's trying to do? And the answer would be that he wants Yaakov to come. He does not believe that Yaakov will trust the brothers with Binyamin. And therefore, if he's going to send Binyamin, he's going to come. And therefore, if Yaakov accompanies Binyamin, Yaakov will then come and bow down together with Binyamin. And at that point, everything is fulfilled. And again, if you'll say, but why does this have to happen? For Yosef, this is the dream, and this is the prophecy, and this is what has to take place. And again, I do believe it has to do with this issue of who's going to be king, which means what's going. And also, I'll add another point. I don't think this is easy for Yosef. I think on the one hand, knowing that this is the prophecy, this has to happen, doesn't mean that he's 100% comfortable with it, because there's something which is very uncomfortable with it. And maybe there's a deeper point to all of this which is worthwhile exploring. When Yaakov raised his children in Laban's house, I assume the relationship with Laban was somewhat dysfunctional, and then that's really what comes out. Laban is not somebody to be loved or trusted. Laban is somebody to be very careful with, which means that as the children of Yaakov grow up, including Yosef, in their formative years, they never see a healthy relationship with the grandparents. Having a relationship with grandparents is, I think, really one of the great blessings that children have. You know, it's the love of the parents without the discipline most of the time. There's another element. There's this softer element involved. There's this loving element involved. And it's important. But there's another issue. Watching parents honor their parents is probably the best lesson that we can possibly have in terms of knowing how to honor our own parents, which means far more important, and this is really the issue in education and child rearing, far more important than the things that we say or the things that we do. Which means if we tell our kids to do something, but we do the opposite, the odds are we're not going to be all that successful. And this is true in many, 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 many levels. The parent who's going to say to the kid, don't watch so much television, read a book, and the parent never reads a book and watches television, so why in the world do we think that he's going to be successful with that kind of education? On a certain level, children do want to be like parents. Again, it's not always going to happen that every child is going to be like their parents in every single situation, but that's really what children have deep in their minds. They want to be like their parents. And again, I'm not saying that every one of us needs to be like our parents in every single way, but going back to the point, to be blessed to see the way parents treat grandparents is very important in terms of the formative years. I mean, when my grandmother was ill and she had dementia, my parents took her into the home, took us into our home, and had nurses and people taking care of her until the point came that it was finally felt that she would get better care someplace else, because it was very difficult to get really quality people to be helping her. But that lesson of having her live with us for a while was probably one of the most important lessons that I had in terms of watching what really honoring parents is about. And it's not necessarily the present for Mother's Day or for Father's Day or so on and so forth. Those are actions, and those are the kinds of actions which are not the same as the other 364 days in a year. And going back to this point, Yosef doesn't see how Yaakov treats his father, because essentially they're estranged, if not in terms of the relationship, and that's also quite interesting, what really is going to be the relationship when Yaakov does come back, because Yitzchak does know what has happened in terms of the blessing and so on and so forth, and how healthy that relationship is moving further. But I'll leave that point. On a much simpler level, geographically, for the formative years, there is no Yaakov-Yitzchak relationship. There is no Yaakov-Rivka relationship, and the children never see it. Which means rather what we have is long years of estrangement because of a certain goal which needs to take place. And Yosef may understand that part, and he may have internalized that part. Sometimes you need, in terms of honoring parents, there are larger stories taking place, larger issues being unfolded. And Yosef is going to be estranged from his father for years because something, a process needs to take place. And that could very well be exactly the lesson that he learns. It's Chazal do point this out on a certain level by saying many of the things that went on in Yaakov's life later on take place in Yosef's life, including this idea of being estranged from the parent, or being at least distanced from the parents geographically, is something, as I said, Chazal point out. But now realizing this, Yosef may actually be quite conflicted. On the one hand, he needs to honor his father, but on the other hand, there is this prophecy, there is this dream. The God of his father has really implied that this is what needs to take place, and therefore, as Yosef is unfolding this plan, he is trying to get his father to come. And I'll say it again, that point is what I had seen from Rabbi Soloveitchik. He is trying to get his father to come and bow down to him, and if not to him, then at least to Tzafnat Paneach, his Egyptian alter ego. And as we now go through the story, and we try to unpack it, we realize the brothers come, and he says, no, you have to get your father here. Why? Because his father's going to bow down. You have to get your father and Binyamin here. Why? Because they're going to bow down. So now Binyamin comes, and that's maybe a little surprising for Yosef. I mean, the whole family is whole, except Yaakov didn't come. So now he has to now create this whole secondary intrigue in order to get Yaakov to come, which means eventually Binyamin would have been thrown in prison. Presumably the next part would have been, if you want to prove that you're really innocent, again, just trying to understand what his plan would have been. His plan probably would have or should have been, if you want to get your brother out, you claim that you have an elderly father, bring your father to me, and at that point I will let him go. And then Yaakov comes and Yaakov bows down. At that point the dream is completed, the prophecy takes place, and at that point the game would be over, because now Yosef has proven his kingship. Yosef is a king, acknowledged by all. Everyone bows down to him, and the family of Yosef will be kings moving forward. But he breaks down. And how does he break down? Ha'od Avichai. And I think that's the importance over here. His father is the focus, which means at this point, Yosef has given up. At this point, he had says, okay, that's it. I'm not taking this any further. I've taken this as far as I can. Because Yehuda is right. All the things that Yehuda is saying over here about my father and my father and my father, and count how many times Yehuda mentions father along the way over here. And the whole thing is about his relation with the father. And I think every single time he says this, it's like another cut that Yosef feels on his body in terms of, well, what about my relation with my father? My father loved me and I love him. But still, the prophecies, the dreams must come true, the show must go on. But then again, my father, and again, my father, and again, what my father feels, my father's experience, and so on. And at some point, that's what gets to Yosef. And at that point, Yosef makes a decision. And that's what we really need to understand unfolds here. He sacrifices, ultimately, to be the king in terms of his father. His father will not bow down to him. Yaakov will not bow down to him. And Yosef gives up on that, because the only way he bows down to him is if he doesn't know that it's Yosef. And Yosef believed that that's what he needs to do in order to achieve this idea of kingship. Again, it's interesting. Reuven tries to take a wife or a pilegesh, a concubine of Yaakov, to show that he deserves to be king. And Yosef does something else. He tries to get his father to bow to him to show that he should be king. And the winner of all this is Yehuda, who becomes king. And what does he do to become king? He shows the great concern and empathy and compassion. All the things, by the way, that we never knew that Yehuda had in him. All of these parts of his personality, which he seems to develop later on, and watching the Yehuda personality develop and so on. Who would have thought that why he deserves to be king? Well, he stands up to Yosef. That's one thing. He speaks to him, and he's not afraid, and he gives a speech, but the speech is fascinating because the speech is full of emotion, and the emotion is all about how he feels towards his father. And as he's speaking, Yosef realizes that all of what Yehuda has and he feels and is willing to sacrifice for is something that that Yosef just doesn't have. But at that moment, Yosef does sacrifice. In a sense, he does exactly what Yehuda does, and he sacrifices everything for his father. But at that point, his dream of his father bowing down to him has come to an end. And therefore, of course, this emotional outbreak that Yehuda has is, my father's still alive. Of course, these are the words that he has to say at this point, because that's what's on his mind. His father is still alive. He needs to fix things with his father. Forget about this interpretation of the dream. Forget about this idea of his father ever bowing down to him. It's God's problem. God will decide who will be king and how they'll be king and what will happen. But at this point, Yosef watching his father, Yosef watching Yehuda being willing to sacrifice everything for the sake of his father, inspires Yosef to sacrifice his plan, to sacrifice his dreams, to sacrifice his prophecy in order to reestablish the relationship with his father. And at that point, we realize that Yehuda remains standing, and now he's the only candidate who indeed will one day be king.